Women notoriously will underpay themselves to make sure the business is running, but not understanding that the stress they're feeling from the lack of personal compensation coming out of that company is impacting their household. And so then it does impact how they market and sell the product and services that they have.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your company's spend, but we're with magical features, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Audrey Godwin from The Audrey Company. I'm definitely going to be asking about the naming of that. And today as a topic, we're going to be talking about picking your ideal customer. A couple of years ago, I heard someone on Twitter say that if you don't like frat boys, don't open an Irish pub. And it was another way of saying that, you know, picking your customers, some people who you love working with, is half the battle and really maybe all of the battle in terms of creating a successful business. So we're going to chat about this. We're going to talk about maybe some stories of fishy bookkeeping and a couple of other things. Audrey, thanks very much for coming on the show. Whereabouts in the world are you sitting today?
Well, thanks for having me. I'm actually sitting in Tulsa, Oklahoma in the United States.
Fantastic. So maybe you could just give us a little bit of your background of what life is like in Tulsa as a CPA and fractional CFO.
Yeah, so I've only been in Tulsa a couple of years. I moved from the Seattle area. I actually hung up my CPA license, so I'm only doing fractional CFO work. And loving every moment of it. I've been working in the entrepreneur founder eco space here in Tulsa, but I also still have clients that I do fractional CFO work in various states around the country. And just here hanging with my dog and myself, because I'm on a new adventure in life since my children are adults now, living their own best life.
So I'm terrible at naming things, and I have a terrible story about why we're called Procurement Express, which we won't get into now. But your name really stood out, The Audrey Company. Where was the inspiration for that? Because it's memorable and it's very personable. I love it. How did you come up with the name?
Well, one, it's my first name.
Sure.
And when I had my CPA firm, it was called the Godwin Group, because, you know, CPAs have to, it's self-naming, and that's part of the rules. But I was thinking about the meaning of my name, right? So the name Audrey means noble strength. And when I think about serving in the financial arena, you can get weak at the knees a little bit trying to deal with managing finances, you know, trying to grow a company, trying to maintain a company, or even dealing with your personal finances if you're dealing, you know, if you, you know, work a W-2 job, you know, 9-to-5 job. So at this point, I decided that we would just call it the Audrey Company, because I think with women particularly, there is a noble strength and honorable power in getting to a place where they really do want to steward the finances well, whether it's personally for their household or for their business.
Yeah, great. And you know, you've made a focus on serving women in particular, which I'm going to get into. But before we get into that, maybe you could just bring us back to the start of your career. One of my early podcasts here, going back a long time ago now, I had my friend Robert Hartline and he told a story of how he ran a chain of phone stores in the US, and he discovered some embezzlement within his business, if you like. And it was an interesting story. If you haven't heard that podcast, I recommend you have a look at it. It's a story about how his bookkeeper or his accountant stole $300K from him, and he managed to get it back. So I'll tease people with that. But you had your own experience working as an auditor, coming across some sort of fishy situations. Maybe you could just fill us in on what it was like to have to deal with that.
Early in my career, so I just, you know, it was probably about the early 90s when I started as a CPA, and it was one of my first audits. And because I had worked in private industry as a controller, you know, the joke was always I could come in and go, hey, I'm the new kid on the team. I have to just ask some questions around internal controls. And, you know, for internal controls, it's like, you know, do we have segregation of duties? Meaning, is the bookkeeper doing all the things for all the areas of finance, right? Are they creating the customer name? Are they submitting the invoices? Are they, you know, receiving the money? Are they making the deposits at reconciling the books? Are they creating, you know, vendors, are they approving the accredited vendors, all of those things. So I get the idea that it's like, oh, let me sit down with the bookkeeper and, you know, talk about internal controls under the guise of, hey, I'm new on the team. And so as we talked about things, I kind of noticed, and keep in mind, this is the early 90s. So I'm pretty clear, aware of what the salary level is for a bookkeeper, office manager slash person. And I kept noticing, like, she has this really beautiful ring. And I asked her about, you know, the beautiful ring. She's like, oh, it was a gift for my husband. And I'm like, oh, okay. And so we talked some more, went through some things. You know, there were a couple of things that I was like, huh, that's a little odd. Didn't really think too much about it. She kept mentioning like cash flow was always tight. And I'm like, well, what do you think? And she's like, well, you know, I just think it's a small business and, you know, just added costs. And she wasn't really specific, which is weird from my perspective. And that usually bookkeepers are so focused on the details. They can tell you, hey, the owner keeps taking money out. So every time we say we're going to pay this, they want to take it out because they're buying a boat or whatever the case may be. But she was very vague in her questions. And then one day during the audit, I noticed the car she drew up, like beautiful brand new Mercedes. And I'm like, so her husband has passed, unless he left her a boat ton of money. Right. I'm like, wow, what a beautiful vehicle. And so we talked about the car and then I said, you know, cause I kept telling my manager, like something is off. I can't put my finger on it. And then I asked the owner, I said, hey, does she ever take vacation? I said, because it feels like she's always here, because other employees will say like, oh, she's just a fixture. She must sleep under her desk. I mean, like, and I thought, okay, something else is going on. And so she went out to lunch one day and the owner decides to come in and he said he decided to look. He opened a drawer because he was looking for the key to the petty cash box, opened this drawer. And there are letters stacked from the IRS of unpaid payroll taxes.
Wow.
Which cost him a ridiculous amount of money. And then when we decided to look a little further, we had also found that she was kind of leaking money out through petty cash because she didn't have to get a second signature for petty cash if it was under $1,000. And so over time, she had, you know, embezzled money through petty cash and had not been paying payroll taxes for the company.
And was this something, what had triggered the audit? Was there a suspicion before you went in there, or was it just no, totally irregular,
no, this
something
was,
totally separate?
This was totally separate in that they were growing. So they were looking for a line of credit in the bank at a certain level of income. The bank wanted to have audited financial statements. So that's sort of the highest level of assurance for a bank. They would want an audit because you're required to now evaluate internal controls. The bank's comfortable, and they had never needed an audit before. And you know, they were smaller. So a compiled or reviewed statement was fine, but they were considering expanding, looking for more, a larger line of credit and some more equity. And so the bank was like, no, we want you to do an audit. So because of that, and because what's necessary for us to perform an audit and get a level of assurance that we're good, we can give a clean opinion. That's how this was uncovered.
Right. And then, so what was the next, how was it handled then? Because these things sometimes get swept under the carpet. Sometimes they just go to the bank and say, oh, actually, never mind, we're not interested in that loan anymore.
So basically, they had a really great relationship with the banker. And so they said, hey, here's what's happening with the audit. We uncovered these things. So we're probably not going to move forward right now. We really want to get our ducks in a row, get our systems straightened. The bank was fine, right? And then, you know, she was subsequently fired. And like most small businesses, they don't press charges for fear of the bad publicity. I said, but here's what's happening is somebody else is going to hire her. That may be the same thing. I said, and then they have to be careful on the kind of referral they give when, you know, they're doing reference checks.
in the stories I have heard of this before, someone who's done it once is quite likely to go on and do it again. So you're in this awkward position as a business holder where you don't want to be liable yourself, but where's your,
right?
Where's the morals in this?
It's hard. Yeah. I think, you know, to be honest, if more small business, and I think it's more of they're afraid of the press, and it could be a bit of embarrassment for the owner. How could I not see this? Gosh, she reminded me of like my grandmother. She's so, you know, meticulous and she's so this. And so they don't want to, they don't want bad press of, you know, people finding out that they had a bookkeeper that embezzled from them. They don't want to press charges, but the only way you stop this from happening, you know, continuing to occur is to press charges. But because those are public records, nobody really wants to, you know, other people to know, well, this is what happened. And unfortunately, that person will continue to get a job.
So that's interesting. So on your website, the, you know, theaudreycompany.com, you reference you're part of the Kingdom Entrepreneurs Group, or maybe you tell us a bit about that. That seems like, was it something, does that framework give you any guidance for what to do here? Or no, is that totally separate?
Well, Kingdom Driven Entrepreneur is a Christian faith tradition based organization. And so I am a certified service provider, meaning anyone who hires me knows that one, me and Jesus are, we're kind of tight, but that my Christian faith, it, you know, drives how I serve, right? So part of the framework with Kingdom Driven Entrepreneur is that, you know, we look at partnering with God. How are we being directed? Are we being generous? Are we being good stewards? How do we market with integrity and not pressure? How do we sell in a way that says that I am providing, you know, my product or service is what you need, not just because I need the cash flow to hit my business. So it really not just helps you grow and maintain a business in a way that would honor Christ. It is also a way that checks your heart and your motivations for why you're marketing, why you're selling. Are we there to serve? Are we solving a problem? You know, and to show that when you really do take care of people, all the stakeholders, you will be profitable and cash flow positive.
Yeah, because there seems to be, we'll get into it, where there seems to be sometimes there's a bit of a, would you say guilt around, you know, charging for things and asking for money and then reconciling that with serving, right? There's like, it's two things are at odds there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's because it's how we're trained, right? Like money is a dirty, bad thing. It's like, no, because you usually, you know, we can't barter anymore. We're not one, you know, there aren't many family farms anymore. So it's not like we could trade our shoes for food. We have to use some level of currency. And I think part of the teaching in Western American churches, it's money is bad. It's like, no, it's the fact that money is the end all be all for you is what, you know, perverts your ability to really think about serving well, as opposed to how can I just line my pocket? So the idea of pricing becomes, well, I really love this. And I think for women, it becomes, I'm really passionate about this. I can't imagine getting paid for it. It's like, okay, well, if you don't want to get paid for it, then make it a hobby. That's super cool.
Yeah.
But if you're serious about being in business, think it from the perspective of you get to do this. You get to serve people. You get to transform their life with whatever product or service that you're providing, because you're helping people solve a problem. You're helping meet a need. You're helping people overcome a challenge, or you can be just giving them experience. I think about Disneyland, that's an experience, right? But if you position the perspective of I'm here to serve, then it becomes easier to say, oh, my pricing is not based on who I am. It is based on the transformation that my product or service provides.
Yeah, very interesting. So it's actually less about what to do in a moral quandary. It's more about, you know, aligning your faith with service and the other side of that getting paid for it, I guess, which is because, right, I was listening to a podcast the other day about Roman times, and even the Romans had this attitude that, you know, any sort of trade was kind of dirty. Everyone considered themselves a farmer. Unless you were a farmer, you wouldn't really have a real profession. You weren't really producing something yourself. And I guess a lot of technicians, I would class myself as a technician, as a programmer. I had that feeling like, unless I'm actually doing something for someone, that's not work, you know, and that included right. sales and marketing and all these other things, you know. But so cool. So let me just, maybe we could just round out on the story with the audit about what would you look for today, or what advice would you give to small business owners not to end up in that situation where you're susceptible to some sort of embezzlement?
So the first thing I would say is stay involved. Like, don't become sort of a micromanager where everybody's like, I can't do my job because you're right over my shoulder, but mm-hmm. set up systems of review, right? So especially around bookkeeping, if there's only the bookkeeper, you know, ask about, you know, hey, can I see the list of vendors? Can I see our list of customers? And notice, you know, if you have new ones, hey, why do we have this new one? You know, what are they selling us? Did we have that part of a project? Right. Ask those questions. Get on a regular schedule to review your financial statements. Randomly ask for, hey, can you show me the bank reconciliation? Because there are places where we expect the business owner to delegate a certain level of authority and response, but not abdicate total responsibility of like, yeah, I trust them, it's cool. And that's when you don't really know what goes on in people's personal lives, right? Somebody's personal life can go sideways. There could be a diagnosis. There could be, you know, gambling. I've seen that happen as well, where things get crazy at home. They come to work and everything's just normal, but they know that the business owner is disengaged because they're so busy trying to bring business in the door and managing the things that are going on in the business that they don't look at the area of finances with the same keen eye as they would maybe marketing, sales, or operations. So I do say be engaged, set up cadences, ask for things. You know, if you have an outside CPA, every so often to have them sit down with the, you know, your internal staff and just ask for maybe, hey, we want to do a budget. Let's sit and look at your underlying documents, things of that nature.
Yeah. And I mean, you have the idea of the fraud triangle, which is you have people have an opportunity, they have a rationalization or justification and pressure, you know, from like them, like you say, something going on in their personal life. And it might be a situation where someone who may not have normally thought about this, but suddenly, you know, they didn't get their last pay rise. God knows they have a divorce or they have a burglary or they have something. And then, you know, the petty cash is there or whatever. And then the last piece, those two other pieces you can't really do much about as a business owner, but the opportunity is something you can definitely do about. And, you know, you're in a way, you might feel like, well, you know, I trust my staff. I shouldn't have to put checks in place. But really, you're putting them at risk. You're putting them at risk for themselves, mm-hmm. you know, in all sorts of ways. You might have to, if, you know, they might just have a bad day or whatever. Something might not normally happen. Suddenly now, A, you know, obviously it's terrible for their career. B, you have to replace them. It's a hassle. It's safe, safety, absolutely. If nothing else, you know. And, you know, we come across this, you know, actually our one of our founding customers, they had, you know, they had an MD and basically came out in the wash that the MD was reselling goods on the gray market, you know, embezzling from the company. And that meant, well, obviously he got sent to jail. We got a software company, so it wasn't all bad, but he got to jail. We got a software company. But for that business owner, that was a massive, obviously, scandal, reputational risk, mm-hmm. terrible for everyone involved. And now as part of what we do is, you know, if you're just using QuickBooks for, let's say, all your purchasing and your managing, the problem with that is everyone has access to your QuickBooks, right. your bookkeeper has access to all parts of that. They can onboard vendors, they can do all of this. Whereas if you use a tool like Procurement Express or the other ones out there, it separates those responsibilities. So you have four sets of eyes on new vendors, purchase orders, you know, all that sort of stuff. But anyway, I'll stop. Absolutely. I couldn't resist. I couldn't resist selling, Audrey. It was too good for me to start talking about it.
But that's also a great example, right, with purchase orders. Because a lot of times if they're not using digital software solution, you have paper purchase orders in books, right? So, you know, you talked about protecting the employee as well as the company. It's like, so you have a superintendent on job that has a PO book. He, you know, all of a sudden somebody might take the book or take a PO out. He may not notice it's missing. And then all of a sudden, you know, the PO gets used for, you know, we'll say some employee's friend owns a material, electrical supply company. It's like, hey, we're going to do this. And so all of a sudden accounting is getting invoices for a PO that nobody recognizes. Yeah. And then all of a sudden it's that poor superintendent is like, well, it came from his PO book.
Yeah.
It's like, so then it becomes, hey, the reason we're doing something like Procurement Express is because we not only that we want to protect the company, but we also want to protect the employee.
Yeah.
Because now he could be losing his job just because somebody walked into, the job, the office on the job and just pulled his PO book, without him realizing or him giving authorization for that person to take a PO.
Okay, well, that's a cautionary tale. Let's go on to something slightly more uplifting now, which is your mission. And you've decided to work with a particular type of entrepreneur in what you're doing in your CFO services. So maybe you could just describe what brought you to that journey of who do you love? Who's your French kiss in terms of who you love working with most, more than anyone else, and why?
Yeah, I love working with smart and ambitious women. I have worked with men most of my life, most of my career. And what I noticed, especially when I worked with women business owners, when I worked in other firms, or when I would go with them to particular meetings with bankers or financial advisors, they would talk to the women business owner as if, oh, let me just break this down to you, and be very condescending and very patronizing. And then I would be like, but I brought them here to you, and like, she's brilliant in her home. We just need to get financing or have these conversations. And for me, it becomes, understanding that, oh, we are undervaluing our services or our products, so we're undercharging. Well, they get nervous because, I just started this. Okay, but you probably have a whole illustrious career of skills that we can translate this, and people are getting results. So the reason why I wanted to work with women specifically is because I wanted more women to have healthier businesses. There is a statistic here in the U.S. that says, less than 2% of women businesses reach the $1 million mark. Now, that may not be for everyone. And if you look at the underlying data, they have a lot of very micro businesses. But there are women who truly just, they know how to sell, but they don't know how to manage it. And they're afraid to. So they delegate the check, the numbers to the bookkeeper or the CPA. And it's like, yeah, just tell me what I need to owe in taxes. But they don't really understand that they're making decisions about marketing, sales, and operations that literally has a financial impact. It impacts them from, making a good salary. Women notoriously will underpay themselves to make sure the business is running, but not understanding that the stress they're feeling from the lack of personal compensation coming out of that company is impacting their household. And so then it does impact how they market and sell the product and services that they have. And what I notice is they're much more willing. They're coachable, not that men aren't coachable, but they do want to understand the fundamentals of how the pieces fall into place. And they're willing to be educated so that they can make better strategic decisions financially and be a partner to their financial advisor, to their banker, to their CPA, so that their whole team is working together based on, the direction that she wants to take her company.
You said something interesting there, because working as an advisor, a frustration can be that you give people a advice and they ignore it. I mean, that's the thing that puts me off being a director or whatever, is like, nothing worse than... So what I heard there, which is great, is you find that women actually, as a group, we're going to talk in broad generalities here, more likely to take that advice on. Therefore, they're more satisfying for you, and they are actually getting the results because they're taking your advice. So a male may not be as open to actually taking the advice and seeing it come to life.
Right. And to be honest, is that women want to be heard, right? And so to learn, to teach them how to, challenge their CPA. Well, if your gut is telling you something is off, like you don't understand the answer, ask them the question again. Most women won't repeat the question. Now, in this day and age, there are more women pushing forward of like, I really do want to understand this. And of course, my counsel to them is, if you ask a couple of times and you notice that they're getting, whoever you're asking the question to is getting more belligerent or frustrated, one, they may not know how to, couch their answer in a different way because they haven't been asked to really explain it, or two, it's just no longer a right fit. And it's really okay to find a CPA, a banker, a financial advisor that's going to partner with you in making sure that your financial strategies, your tax efficiency actually supports the growth of your business.
So if you're not getting the answers that in a way that you can understand from your advisors, maybe it is them, not you. It could be especially in these technical areas, sometimes that power can be, you know, used for good or ill, let's say. Sometimes there may be, and after all, it is your business. You should know every nook and cranny of it, I would say, you know.
Right.
So coaching people on, yeah, that's good. You should be able to get those answers, you know, backing them up on that. Because it's an interesting topic. Like I can see, we all like dealing with people like us, I guess, you know. So that makes it, that's part of the reason why I like working with fractional CFOs, because they're business people themselves and they're business nerds like I am, generally speaking.
Right.
And I enjoy that whole thing, you know. But if I were to, let me just throw out a prejudice I have, and you tell me where it's right or wrong when it comes to women founders, which is that they are prone to over-servicing clients because that just that mentality of wanting to deliver is, broadly speaking, something that you could, you know, people, maybe women founders, are they more prone to over-servicing than male founders? Male founders are maybe, see you later, sucker, I got the cash, I'm off.
But, yeah, no, I think that is true. And I think women business owners in general, because we have been sort of taught, and I use the word indoctrinated a lot, because we just take it as truth and we'll just run with it as opposed to pushing back and taking personal responsibility. Like, that doesn't jive with my realities. Like, No, I know how to ask these questions. I think a lot of it is we have had, you know, since we've been in the workplace, we have to prove that we have the credibility. We're constantly proving ourselves. And so when we go into running our own businesses, now we have to prove all the time that, you know, we can get you the results. And so we'll undercut the pricing. We may discount it. We may extend, you know, we may have a 6-month contract, but hey, we're getting some results. You know, we'll just add on 30 days without really thinking about, you know, the cost emotionally, mentally, you know, financially, to continue to over deliver without getting fairly compensated for it. Because I think we're still sort of in that, I need to prove to you that this works. There's a level of confidence that we lack because we're just been told that, you know, we don't, you know, we don't work as hard as men. We don't get the results. Yet the data shows that when you look at, you know, companies, whether it's angel investors or VCs, they make investments, the highest, you know, the best returns are from women founders. One, because they make educated risk. It's not an all or nothing thing all the time. They will make more educated risk. They are more committed to sustainability as opposed to, you know, hey, we're going to hire, you know, 100 employees ahead of revenue. They will more than likely hire just in time. And sometimes they'll hire behind what they need, just because they want to manage cash flow better. Because we also know that if we're looking for investment, we may not get the next round going. We may not be able to bring a partner on if we're as risky or taking less educated, gut, you know, driven risk like men do. And men have a better network. They're like, hey, I don't know it, so I'm gonna call up all my people. I just got this new job. I don't know how to do this. How do I do this? Right? Women will look at a job and see 20 requirements, you know, qualifications, because they have 18 and not 20, they won't apply for the job. It's the same thing in business. Like, oh, I need to understand marketing and sales and operations. Nope. Hire people that are smart in that area and learn to ask good questions. It is us learning to be able to trust enough in our ability to lead and ask questions that will keep us from over, you know, I believe in over delivering, but not over delivering service. It's the standard of excellence. Like, you'll come back because you had a really great experience and the product or service worked the way, you know, you promised it would. As opposed to, I'm now going to add all this extra stuff just so that you know that I'm really committed to your success.
That's very interesting. I had a pre-interview for the podcast with effectively investment banker focused on funding female entrepreneurs, and that was the whole thesis of their fund. And they were kind of a search fund, so they were kind of like, you know, they would help vet the opportunities and then find the right funding sources, etc. And the interview didn't happen at the end because that fund found it very difficult to get the backers to actually back the female founders, even though they had gone through this whole process. And obviously, for a lot of the reasons you've talked about, female founders, you know, are very successful. But for this sort of venture end of the business, there was, for whatever reason, this investment banker basically lost, you know, had done all this effort trying to, you know, because female founders are underrepresented specifically for venture funding. And that maybe jives with the prejudice you're talking about there, or maybe it's a reality that for venture funding, you want big risk takers. So do you think that's why those bank, you know, venture funds have been hesitant to back female founders?
I think part of it is networking. Like, it's who you know.
Hmm.
It's if you are going to look for underrepresented and underestimated founders, VCs don't live in those spaces. We don't have access to those spaces. I mean, if you think about the gentleman who blew up WeWork, and then he's out again and raised another, $100 million. It's only because of who he knew. Like, we trust him. We trust his instincts. And I'm like, women don't have those kind of networks. Even if you go to all the elite schools as a woman, you still may not have that level of connection because you're just not a white man.
Okay, well, I'm going to ask you about your business hero in a second. But before I get there, you've reminded me of one of my business heroes, Lulu O'Sullivan. She ran a business here in Dublin. And I remember the thing that I was young, wet behind the ears, 20-something, failing entrepreneur, not doing very well. But I remember meeting Lulu, and she ran a very successful, it was a hamper business based in here in Ireland, but it scaled significantly. And the thing that really struck me about her was she had three beautiful kids, great husband. She took August off every year. And she was really good to me. She gave me, I remember, Tony Robbins' book, I think it was, Unleash the Giant Within or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I went off and I feverishly listened to it or whatever. But it really made me realize, wow, that was kind of, I wasn't married at that stage, but that was the inspiration. I was like, wow, I'd love to, she was 20 years older than me, so I couldn't marry her. But you know, it was inspiration for, you know, the wife I wanted in the end of the day. And a large part of my current wife runs a business and so on. And hopefully my only wife runs a business and so on. And that was a large inspiration for me. You know, female entrepreneurs are pretty cool in my book. Anyway, so that's my business hero. That's what I'm trying out. I thought I'd ask you, who is your business hero, Audrey, and why?
Well, that's a great question. Well, in the Seattle area, there is a family-owned business called McClendon's Hardware. I think they are on generation 4 running the business. And I think the thing that I see that is heroic, especially for family-owned own and run businesses, is that the elder generation actually let the younger generation start to modernize things. They're open to suggestions. It isn't, hey, this is the way your great grandfather did this, and so this is how we're going to do it. Is that they really did value the next generation of leaders that came in. And even for the ones that didn't want to participate in the family business, there was no pressure for them to have a job in the business. It was, no, you go do what you need to do, and we're just going to, you know, bless and release you. But they were really great about making sure that, you know, employees were well treated, that it was not the typical family environment, but the employees that worked there loved working there. I remember meeting a woman who literally had worked there for 40 years when I was part of the, you know, local chamber of commerce. She was just amazing. And she was part of the family, you know, I think she was like a cousin or something that worked in the business, because she just loved working with the family and being able to see that they were really open to the next generation on how they were going to continue to perpetuate this and to have a succession plan of, well, what if none of the great grandkids want to run this business anymore? What will we do? And they were very open to that. So I think for me that If we're talking about legacy, when it comes to business, that would definitely be my hero.
Yeah, and it's super unusual these days. I mean, most businesses, you know, are not. If it's a professional services, it might be 30 years, maybe a lawyer or something, or accountancy firm, but your regular businesses last 5-10 years doing well at this stage.
Absolutely.
I love that story. My family can't even decide together what movie to watch on a Friday night, so I can't imagine us running a business together, but maybe we'll run that
circle. It's like dinner every night. That's the whole big push. Like, what are we eating for dinner? It's like, oh my gosh, if someone doesn't make a decision.
Here we go again.
Soon. Always.
Yeah. Audrey, this has been a lot of fun. How can people reach out to you? I know you're working on a book as well, and there's a lot of resources. You have a lovely website, by the way. It's interesting. Thank resources you. There. So how can they get in touch?
Yeah, so you can reach out to me on LinkedIn. It's Audrey Godwin. You can come and subscribe to our newsletter, Wholesale Finance. You can do that through the website at theaudreycompany.com.
Yeah, great. Thank you very much. And thank you, listener. If you've lasted this long on the podcast, congratulations. Your special gift for your resilience and interest is being able to go to procurementexpress.com/partners. I've created a webinar, and having interviewed dozens of fractional CFOs now, I've put together a webinar which explains how you can work with Procurement Express as a fractional CFO as a partner, but also gives you my view on how to explain the value of hiring a fractional CFO. I think it's one of the most powerful hires you can make in your business, probably the most powerfully impactful hire you can make for your business if you're growing. And go to procurementexpress.com/partners, sign up for the webinar to learn more about how we work with partners like Audrey's and others. So thanks very much, Audrey. Thanks very much for coming along today. And you've been a star.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been fun.